Hi, I'm Kim Bussey Chamberlain, a paramedic, mum, and author. As paramedics, we're often asked, what's the worst thing you've ever seen? And I'm here to encourage a different kind of conversation, to uncover what it takes to work in these frontline roles and the privilege we experience in meeting and connecting with patients. This podcast is all about what it's really like to be a paramedic or any frontline uniform professional. Each week, you get to hear from the real humans under the uniform, the memorable moments they've experienced in their jobs, and the people that have stayed with them for life. Let's hear what life is really like beneath the blue lights. Welcome to Beneath the Blue Lights, the Paramedic Podcast. I'm Kim, your host for this series. Today, I'm honoured to have the brilliant Richard Kingham, Motorcycle Response Paramedic, join us for a chat. The reason I wanted Kingham on the podcast is because he was one of the first paramedics I met when I first came out on the road during my training. His CV is hugely impressive, working on the Motorcycle Response Unit and having worked on HEMS as an air ambulance paramedic as well. In fact, one of the first jobs that I encountered Kingham on was a fairly nasty road traffic accident, car versus motorbike. Fresh out of training school, there I was trying to cut through the patient's leathers. It was surprisingly difficult. I still don't know why we call them tough cuts, to be honest. Kingham arrived on scene, took one look at the absolute hash job I was doing, and shouted, "You're not a fucking seamstress," as he leaned over and started tearing the trousers apart with his hands like an absolute pro. It changed the way I did that forevermore. Honestly, though, whenever I was on a tricky job, if he turned up too, I would instantly feel calmer with his knowledge and experience around. So on that note, hi Kingham, how are you?
Oh, shucks. I don't know what to say, really. Did I really say that? I can't remember.
Yeah. That stuck with me. Really? Sage advice.
I wish I could remember it. I wish I could remember any of them.
It was a dark and stormy night.
Was it really?
It actually was, yeah. It was raining a lot.
Blimey, I apologise for swearing. I think it's a valid point.
It was.
Yeah.
And it was probably some of the best advice I got.
Yeah. Right. Yes. Anyway, that's enough blowing
smoke
up. I'm okay. I'm very well. Yeah, not bad. Yeah, usual level of tiredness that shift work does to you, or a paramedic has. But yeah, a paramedic and having a 5-year-old. There's two.
I don't know which one's harder, actually, to be honest.
Yeah, I think it's probably the 5-year-old. Less mentally, being a paramedic is less mentally exhausting, I think. So.
Yeah, I hear you. Okay, well, let's get a quick background about you, if that's all right. If you could introduce yourself and tell us a bit about why you decided to become a paramedic, how long you've been doing it, and sort of where you started and what you did to get to where you are now.
Okay, so I joined the ambulance service in 98 after... Not really, I wouldn't say it is a vocation for me, but actually what I did was I wanted to be in the RSPCA as an inspector. And I applied to them. I was mad on animals, always still am and always will be. And I applied to the RSPCA. And then I found out you had to put animals down as part of your job. And I was like, oh, can't do that. And I was always into motorbikes. And somebody mentioned being a bike paramedic. And I thought, that's quite cool. And just applied, and it just went from there. I had a friend who was in the service down in Eastbourne, and so when I joined, it was a very different service to when you joined, Kim. Mm-hmm. It was very old school, and they were old, like, I'm a dinosaur now, but then it really was, it was old men, seen everything, been around the block, you know, have a cigarette out the window, and as they were going to calls and that, and it was just a very different world. What it is now, very much more professional now. I applied in 97, got in, went through as a technician in Hillingdon, joined Hillingdon and worked Heathrow, Hillingdon and Hayes, then got married and moved to Croydon. I was at Croydon for 8 years on the road on cars and ambulances doing various things. And then the chance to be a biker came up because they expanded the bike unit and the chance to be a biker came up and I applied for the bike. So I've been into bikes since I was about 19. I must have been about 28 then, I think. Hang on, I'm trying to think how old I am now. No, I must be a bit older. 30, or in my 30s, let's go with that. And I applied for the bikes and got it. And it was a it was at Waterloo. Waterloo's always been called Hollywood in the London Ambulance Service, and that was that. So I then got on the bike unit, done the training. It's hardest, by far the hardest, most scary training course I've ever done, because you're riding about a motorbike, riding on a motorbike, and trying not to die, I think is the only way I could describe it. It was absolutely petrifying for 3 weeks. And then from then on, just went, stayed on the bikes, met you, Kim, and swore at students, I think that's reasonable to say.
Apparently so.
Yeah. Does that sound about right? Cool. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting to hear actually where you kind of started out and thinking about actually the RSPCA and stuff first. And then having that realisation.
Yeah, it's much more me. I think my heart lies with sort of animal welfare. Certainly my partner now and I are both massively into it. So, I think because I started, before I'd done this, I actually worked for a dog kennel. I worked with greyhounds. It's 80 plus greyhounds. Oh. This was when I was 18, 19. And let me tell you, the smell of 80 greyhounds with a hangover. That's why this prepared me for this job.
Yeah, I was going to say, perfect training for this, actually.
Yeah.
The smells.
Yeah.
It's
quite astounding. But then after that, when I realised I wanted to go into this sort of work, I worked for a company called the Disabilities Trust with physically handicapped adults and then for MenCap as well, which I'd say is probably the best training you could have for communication, because the people, a lot of the people I was working with were non-verbal, autistic, using word boards and literally you could not say a word to you. So you learn to communicate very easily. Mm-hmm. So actually this job is, compared to that, with communications, easy.
Yeah.
And you learn, the charity I work for is a very high standard, and you learn a standard of care that I try and adhere to now, actually. Mm-hmm. If I go into a home or a house or somewhere that doesn't have my standard of care, then I'm not happy. I'd sort of, I'm a bit of an expert in hoists. Hoists, what a thing.
Yeah. We've all got our niche area.
I know everyone. Yeah, that's my niche, is hoists. And you go into places, and you've been there, Kim, when they say, I don't know how to use the hoist. I'm like, come
Hold
here. bring it to, you're going to get a lesson. So, and I'm quite into that. So I just like good care. That's my thing. So
And I've seen it firsthand as well, which is always good to see.
Yeah, I'd like to think I give a monkey still, and that's not bad for 23 years.
Yeah, it's massively
I give a monkey's
important.
About patience. I'm passionate about patience, and I think we use this term care, and we think it necessarily is all going to be like they're touching their arm, but actually it can be a negative thing as well. It can be actually. Say no, you're not going to do that. And does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah,
I think there's one of those shows like Ambulance or something that I watched a little while ago, and it was just, it perfectly summarised it as well, about saying, you're going into these patients' homes, and sometimes it's just about what else you can do for them as well. I can show you how to use the hoist. I think one of the guys on that episode I watched was like, this poor lady had a broken toilet seat and she was elderly and struggling with her mobility, and he was like, well, give me a second, I'll put that new toilet seat on for you before we leave. And actually it's that kind of thing.
I can't count the amount of batteries I've changed in
smoke
alarms,
firearms
and stuff like that. That's it. It's astounding, and I can't believe how many people still have smoke alarms beeping and don't even notice it. That just never fails to amaze me. But I totally agree. So it's not, I think we get tied up in paramedicine, in actual medicine. And I'd say you rarely use medicine. You use a lot of your lateral thought. And, you never know what you're going to be doing in somebody's house. The other day I was with one of your friends, Jen Jackson, and we were in there cleaning up this lady's mess as she'd made her way to the toilet. Let me just leave it at that. And she found it hilarious because she was dealing with a patient and I was scrubbing literally on my hands and knees, scrubbing the floor, scrubbing her carpet.
How did she manage to make it that way around then?
She was on the board.
Okay.
she was attending. And I'm not, it's only poo.
Oh, no, I can't. That's my...
As soon as you mop it up,
it
doesn't stink anymore.
Yeah.
Really. That's your sword. That's yours.
Yeah,
your Achilles heel. Yeah, I'm the same with... ulcerated legs. I can't be dealing with it.
Yeah. That, yeah, they're pretty bad as well. But no, it's the poo for me, actually.
Yeah. You've had babies as well. Goodness.
Yeah. So being a paramedic obviously comes with a lot of responsibility. We're there to help people when they're at their most vulnerable. One of my pet peeves is this question that I've been asked a lot, and I sort of want to unpack it a bit and talk about that in a different kind of way. But I'm kind of wondering if you've ever been asked it as well. This, what's the worst job you've ever seen? When you tell someone, oh, I'm a paramedic, and then they come back at you with, tell me the most horrifying thing you've ever seen.
Yeah, my bulk standard answer is my pay packet. But if it's somebody being like, I've been to dinner parties and had this asked to me, and it depends on the individual. If I'm feeling grumpy or a bit pissed, I generally say, and I heard this from another friend of ours, Seb, and he said, "Dead baby," and it's true. It's the worst job.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
I don't know what people want to hear, but a paed arrest is the worst thing. Yeah, and it's difficult to sort of. Luckily, you know, I think we're all quite lucky. We don't do that many, but one's too many. And when you've got kids, when my daughter was born, I did one, and I got a phone call, and her picture came up on my phone. And I'm like, I'm not ready for that.
Mm.
So yeah, so Peter S, you know, I will say dead baby, and it shuts them up.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's the thing as well. Like, what are they expecting to hear from that? Like, what?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
what do you want from that?
Yeah.
Mm.
And I know I'm almost like, that's quite a rude question to ask me now. And it does depend on the injury. And I don't mind talking about work and stuff and jobs that I've done, but it does depend on the individual and how it's asked. If it's something, straight away in there, what's the worst thing you've seen? I'm like, dead baby. And I'm doing it to gauge their reaction, if anything, and seeing what they say or how they react. And, you know, you wanted to know.
Yeah.
It's like, then don't look at me like I'm the arse. It's you wanted to know, I told you, now shut up.
Yeah So, well, that's one way to shut down that conversation.
It does, yeah. It shuts it straight away, shuts it down, you know. And then depending on their reaction, you know, I've had people apologize for asking, and I'll say, look, and I'll explain my reasons behind it, and then I will tell them about, you know, the bottles up backsides and stuff like that. So
I think that's one of the things, isn't it? I suppose sometimes I think people haven't really fully thought through the question that they're asking. And I always think about it as well in terms of it reminds me of this question that used to be asked a lot to people working in the military, and then it became common knowledge that, of course, you wouldn't go up to someone who's come back from active service and be like, oh, how many people did you kill? And that became sort of common knowledge that was not acceptable as these conversations of, especially around mental health, started coming up more. And I think that's probably like a similar question to us in our profession at the moment. And we're now only starting to voice, probably in a more public place, like, we don't like that question. Don't ask us that.
No. And I think it's one of the questions where you don't realize you don't like it till you've done a few years.
Yeah.
Because I think when you first get your epaulets, you're like, oh, I'm the paramedic, I'm this, I'm that. And you've not, fortunately, not had been through that mill of having the shocking jobs to get that in your arsenal almost, you know, and you're quite happy to talk about the horrible stuff. And it's, I don't know, it's wrong. I don't like the word hero, but you get this status with this job and I don't like it. And I think as you go through, do a few years, you go, actually, this isn't good. This isn't. You know, and I always say this to people, you know, you mentioned my HEMS career, and that people go on about HEMS and I want to do HEMS. And actually, HEMS, you're going into people's lives on the worst day of their life, absolute worst day of their life. And you shouldn't get off on that. You shouldn't be using that as almost like a, it's almost a positive. And you know, this is bad, and have the wherewithal to understand that, you know, and the humility. And that's one of my things about having young staff. I don't know how old you were when
I was in my training. 20s.
You were a bit older, weren't you?
Yeah. Mid-20s.
So you actually, that's why I liked you.
Still swore at me though, didn't you?
But yeah, we were very, sorry. I think the young staff, and it's not their fault, is that you can't learn humility when you're just, you know, when you start, you're 18 in university, it's very difficult to understand what the word humility mm-hmm. means and empathy means, because you've not yeah. lived life, you know. And I tell them to go traveling, go and see the world before they start this, because it will ruin you as a child, as you know, as a kid yeah. almost, you know. So
yeah, for yeah. sure. I guess leading on from that, what questions do you think people should be yeah. asking us instead? Because like you said, we do like talking about our jobs, actually. And yeah. I think as paramedics, you can't do this job and not care about it. It's not something that you just do as your yeah, job, yeah. as your day job. It's, you know, we do care about what we're doing. We're yeah, passionate yeah. about it. And so we are happy to talk to people when they are interested in the profession and in what we do in it. And so what should they be asking us, do you reckon?
Yeah. I don't mind answering that question. I think you should set it up, though. You sit there and say, do you mind talking mm-hmm. about this? Or is this something you're okay talking about? Don't just come in and go, what's the yeah. thing you see? You know, because it's almost flippant and rude. Whereas if you set it up, I'm quite happy to talk about, you know, if you want to talk about a breakdown of the likelihood of survivability of a paed arrest, mm-hmm. then that's fine. Because you won't want to know the answer, trust me. You won't want to know the ins and outs of it. So, yeah. But, yeah, set it up and just be polite about it. But don't expect a, you know, gore yeah. and stuff like that. Because it's not like, really yeah. is that, you know.
And also it's like a bit gratuitous, isn't it, as well? You're in those situations and it's like, yeah, a bit gratuitous, I guess.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think it's for us to understand. I think one of the things we have to understand is humans are ghoulish. We are ghoulish by nature. You know, and I think you and I both are able to now drive past the RTC on the motorway and look the other way because I'm not getting involved. You know, and you have that strength within you if you do a few years. But people do want to know what's going on with their neighbours, mm-hmm. you know, when they see an ambulance there. So it's just inquisitiveness, isn't it? You know, and I find it's probably us. I will say to staff, actually, we go around thinking that the world is weird, and actually we're the weirdos.
I like that. Yeah.
I do believe that. I do believe we are. We're the odd ones, because we, you know, the analogy I always give is, so you and I are working on an ambulance together, okay? We go to a call where, you know, and it doesn't happen as much now, but when we get somebody who we know is expected dead and we know they're been there a while, possibly. So we turn up in our ambulance, we pull up outside and we spot a coffee shop across the road, right? Our first thought generally isn't there's a dead body in there. Our first thought is there's a dead body in there, but there is coffee there.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And we're like, result. And that's what makes our day. We go, oh, brilliant, we get coffee now whilst doing our paperwork. I mean, that is not a normal reaction. And that's why I say we're the weird ones. We're the very odd ones for having that mindset. And I understand what it is. It's just, your coping mechanisms for mm-hmm. what you're about to do. You know, and when you do, the more and more you do that, the more and more you go to the sort of the dead bodies that are, you know, rotting away. You think, well, my attitude has always been, I don't want to get involved in that. If I don't need to, yeah. I don't need that in my head. So if I know they're dead, I'll go, yeah, yeah, they're dead. And I walk out. I don't want that imagery. And I certainly wouldn't want a junior member of staff to put it in their head as well. Because I remember, this is like going back to when I joined, it was like, go on, son, get in there, have a look. And it's almost this blackness about going and getting it, like blooding yourself with this horrible thing. And I've always been the opposite. I'm like, no, I don't need to see it.
Yeah.
I can see they're dead. That's been done. You know, and give them a bit of respect. Mm-hmm. I quite like that as well. Let's get, you know. So I waffled on a bit.
No,
there.
It's really interesting. It's interesting to hear about. So I guess that also leads us into thinking about mental health in this job. And like you said, when you first started out, I think it was probably a different sort of ambulance service. And I think now things are beginning to change, but probably we're not quite there yet in terms of how we talk about mental health in the job and kind of the importance that's placed on that. I think all of us have probably found ourselves in situations where we've had a tough time and maybe we haven't had kind of as much support or haven't been able to talk about it in the way that maybe would have been healthy for us. But in terms of that, what does mental health in the job mean to you? especially at the moment, it's been extra pressure working through this global pandemic, you know, on top of everything else that you have to deal with in this job. So what does it mean to you?
Well, I think firstly, like mental health in this job, I think we try and pigeonhole it into one thing, and it's not. It's so multifaceted. It's really, for me, it's, and I'd probably suggest the majority of staff, there is no downtime now. There is no time to meet with your colleagues and have that. You know, when, even when you joined, we had that, we had a good relationship with each other on station, and it was bants and that, and it, we decompressed. Now that doesn't exist. And there seems to be no way of getting back to that. But I, it, like I said, it's a different different service. But what I would say, in the old days, there was a lot more support from your colleagues, I'd say. Okay. And also what they do is building resilience into you. So you had the banter and the mickey taking. And I'm not talking about bullying, because that's a different subject altogether. I'm talking about, you know, these, you know, the mickey taking was horrendous, but really, really funny. You've been there when the bikers have been going at it, you know, and it's hilarious. It's just, you laugh like a drain all day, or, you know, as much as you can, and you're mucking around, and that was a decompression. But on the, when you're having a bad day, them guys will be like, you're right, what do you need? And they'll be, you can ring them up, and you, and it, that doesn't seem to exist. And maybe it's my generation, or, you know, you're younger than me, so maybe you could tell me otherwise, but it doesn't seem like staff have got that. They don't seem to have that thing of where they come in, relieve each other early so they can get away and stuff like that, because we are so busy now. So there's like loads of this little things that used to happen that staff now don't get. And I'd like to see, I'd like to think, I remember like the mess room used to be a sacred place. It really was. You couldn't, you know, the officers weren't allowed to walk in there. Now, rightly or wrongly, that was, but they weren't allowed to walk in there without knocking. So staff in there were allowed to say what they want and behave, certainly badly when I was young, right? But it was certainly, you know, you could also, you could say what you want, and there was, you had, it was confidential. You wouldn't, you know, and people would argue and fight and that, but they wouldn't, it wouldn't go anywhere else.
Yep.
So people felt supported. You know, if you and I had a problem, we'd go, right, let's go in the garage, we'd discuss it. Done. And that was it. Now we have things in place which we think are good. I'm not sure they are. I don't know. That's a big question. But I think the whole thing, like I say, the problem has changed. I don't think staff have resilience like they used to, because they're too young. And they don't get the support of their peers, because their peer, the peer group's getting smaller and smaller. So they don't get that. Strong peer group to look up to. Like you said, when you introduced me, it's like that thing, somebody to, I'm a dying breed now, I'm more than aware of that, you know. Like you said, you sort of alluded that you saw that in a positive light, and I don't think that exists.
Yeah, I think it's so transient now as well. I think, like for me, one of the things was working on this relief rotor, which meant I was constantly in a different place, in a different station, and through my training, I was really felt a lot of support, and I got to know a lot of people at my base station with you, and that was brilliant. And it, you felt so much better about, you know, taking things on. And then you suddenly become like nomadic on this relief rotor, and you walk into a place and you realize you don't actually know anyone at that station that day where you're working, and that's tough. And I think it doesn't let you build those important relationships at work that probably make a huge difference actually to our mental health there.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. Yeah, totally. Yeah, and I think what I find with the relief rotor, we know that's the hardest thing, and it doesn't seem to be any movement to want to change that. It doesn't, you know, you want to talk about how we would change it. One thing I would do is I'd make the ambulance, out of all the specialist assets, the most comfortable place to be, because that's the busiest and it's certainly the most relentless. We do the opposite. We have the ambulance service, I have ambulances, which is doing all the vast bulk of the work, and it's the most uncomfortable place to be. Whereas your assets like MIU, myself, CRU, the push bikes, HEMS, and they have the best life, heart, they have the training, they have, you know, and that's back to front for me. And I don't understand that. You know, I'd say look after the biggest bit of it more and wrap them in cotton wool, and there's no movement. And you can't help but feel you're just a bum on a seat. And I think the problem is with the London Ambulance Service, we are so big. It's very difficult to manage.
No,
very,
me neither.
And I wouldn't want the job.
So what do you do in terms of looking after your mental health? Like, do you have hobbies and things? Obviously, you talked about also loving animals and stuff. And what do you get up to that helps you?
Yeah. So I like... physical wise, I quite like lifting up heavy things. I like Olympic weightlifting, stuff like that. I'm quite into that. I'm not very good at it. I can lift, but badly. But yeah, I quite like that. Burning my arms out, And my partner always says I'm a better person when I've been training. So I have to remind myself that and then go training. But she certainly says, you're easier to live with when you've been training. So that's one thing. But before COVID, I'd say one of the things we love to do is being a bit spontaneity is the best thing for my, for my mental health. Going to see a band, go and see some music that we do, something you've never done before. And actually, like last weekend, I went to a cheese barge. I recommend it.
Nice.
And that was all my partner's idea to take me to a cheese barge. So yeah, just have a bit of spontaneous life and don't plan too much. Because I think the MO of a paramedic, we're not really good decision makers outside of work, apparently. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Have you ever noticed that you can't choose a biscuit, but you can go to work and it's apparently our MO is to, because we make decisions quickly at work and
all
then we come out with all that.
Like fatigue.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah, precisely. But then the other thing, I think like de-stressing is having a 5-year-old. Having a 5-year-old, how old are yours? They're
I've got
young,
a 2-year-old and an almost 1-year-old now.
Right. So, like toddlers just live in the moment anyway. So you're forced to go along with that, aren't you? So
yeah, it's great.
She's brilliant.
Yeah.
I've got a good one as well, which helps, I'm smug. I'm good. And she sleeps quite well and stuff like that. She always has. So,
That's the best bit then.
Hallelujah. Do you know what? The amount of hate I've had from people when I tell them that, you slept for 3 months. People look at me with absolute hatred.
Yeah, that's like cardinal sin, sharing that amongst parents, isn't it?
I think like with regards to stress, I found with like recent stress, it wasn't just one thing. I think when you have stress at work, you deal with it. If you have stress at home, you deal with it. When you have both, which I had, with a change of relationship, change of lifestyle almost, that was horrendous. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time I'd ever really noticed I was stressed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was quite bad for a while, and it manifested in headaches and being a paramedic, I had a brain tumor, of course, and so took some paracetamol.
It's the worst thing, isn't it? Like medical knowledge, which just makes everything a panic.
Yeah,
and people are like, it must be really good having kids and having medical knowledge, and I'm like, oh no, the kid gets something, and I'm like, oh my god, they've got sepsis. We're going down that pathway already.
Exactly,
no, it's terrible.
My little one, she had a lump on her leg, and I knew it was just a lump. It was a fatty lump. And I came home and I found this thing, and I sort of spoke to my partner, and she was, there's nothing, it's nothing. And it just sent me a bit. And I was stressed from everything anyway, for other reasons. And it just sent me wild. And I had to speak to my mate, who's a consultant, A&E consultant, and he was like, "Don't, it does sound nothing. Don't worry about it." And he said, if you go to your GP, they're going to go, well, wait and see.
Yeah.
So, and do you know what? I went to the GP and they went, wait and see. I was like, okay. And it was nothing. By the time we went back, it was gone. And it was just, and it was all stress.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all it was. And I had my moment and my partner was amazing, but you can't do anything about it. I think you just got to go through it.
You just have to ride it out.
You just sit there and you, yeah, definitely was that. And I think I do this every day with patients. I talk to them in this way. And there's me doing exactly what they do. And I couldn't preach what I was, I couldn't, well, practice what I preach, that's it, yeah. So, it's so annoying. But, yes.
So following on from that, I guess, thinking about stuff that we do want to talk about, and I think you mentioned as well, having, that sense of humour and stuff around things. Are there any moments from the job and any jobs that you've been to that stick with you and stand out? Maybe there's something that warms your heart, or... it's funny or strange situations that you've sort of found yourself in at work that you would want to share.
Yeah. I mean, there's loads. Do you know what? My problem is now, I've got so many. And I remember saying I should write these down, but I can't remember them. But then somebody will say to me, oh, yeah, I've done this. I've done that. But, yeah, there's obviously the thing up the backside. Everyone asks about the thing up the
there's
backside.
There's so many.
I know. And I went to an elderly gentleman, and I walked in his house, and I was with this a mate called Mark, and I was in front of him. I said, what's happening today? And he said, I remember his words very well. He said, I appear to have a bottle up my anus. And I remember thinking, you don't appear to me. This is definitive. You know, it's neither this way or that. It's either up there or it's not. And he said, should we go up there and take it out? And all I can hear is Mark snorting behind me. He had to walk out again. And I'm like, oh my God. Right. I said, no. Because obviously that's potentially surgical. And I'm like, no, come on, mate. And so that's quite memorable. and where we work, as you know, we see a lot of, in central London, we see a lot of different communities. How do I put this, Kim? along the South Bank. So the saunas,
oh, yeah.
I'll just leave it at that, keep us very busy. Now, bear in mind, I wear leather and I have to go into gentlemen's saunas.
You're a very popular guy.
A very popular guy, and I look like a bear anyway. So, going into, and it's you know, you do learn quite quickly the sordid world. And it's like, again, it's funny, but sometimes it's very sad. You know, I think one of the last times I was in one, it was a dead gentleman, and it turns out, you know, the police go just lock on, he's married, and you think, this is going to be, the repercussions from this are horrendous. Because he was married with kids, and he's been attending gay saunas for some years. Now, I don't know the ins and outs of it, but my brain goes, that poor family, that man may well have had a cure for cancer, okay, but he'll never be remembered for that.
It will be this.
He'll be remembered for dying in a sauna. Yeah. And obviously, like, I mean, the memorable ones are ones that have been in the news. Certainly when I was on Hemp's, the memorable ones were ones where I attended one in London, where I come from in London, and this was a fatal RTC, and the individuals involved were young kids, and my Facebook page the next day was all alight with my friends from school. It was their kids knew them, mm-hmm. and they were at the same party and all this, and that made it really human. Actually, I'm coming away from that thinking that's weird now, because I can't pigeonhole that. Because it's almost like a different part of my life. Does that make sense? I didn't enjoy that. I didn't enjoy that because it made it very human.
Yeah, I think when you read something like that as well in the press, often it like pads out that character, right? When we see the patient, they're just our patient. We're focused on what's happening and what we need to do in what's that situation. And then if you leave and it's something that ends up in the press, and you're then, you know, flicking through your paper the next day or a couple of days later, and then it fills that story for you. It creates a whole story around that person.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're reading it and you can't help but read it. And at the same time you're thinking, no, this is going to make this so much harder. To sort of.
Absolutely. I mean, like, there was another one where it was a child. I won't talk about the actual job, but it was a child who was non-English speaking, and his parents were from this country, and they spoke. This is the one I'd say sticks with me the most. And I remember just being gutted that I didn't just ask them, you know, when like you got an unconscious kid, he was badly injured. And I wish I'd asked them, I should have the brain space to ask the parents, you're okay in their language, just so I could say it to the child. My daughter was about the same age. And I was like, I wish the thought of, and this will get you as well, I think, is the thought of my daughter being afraid and like being able to hear, because we know like conscious people can hear something. And I just wish I'd gone, you're okay, in his language. And that's the one that beats me up still to this day. It still beats me up. And it's so silly, isn't it? And it's such a stupid, and I know we saved his life.
And there's
so
much more around it. You
absolutely,
know,
yeah. We saved his life.
Hopefully he will have felt that as well, and felt like he was in safe hands, and that feeling goes further than language. But it's those tiny little things that then will stick with you and they just get into your brain more and more and more.
Absolutely, and even now, I say to back, you know, I still say about it now, and it was years ago. You know, and yeah, I can think about it now, and it just upsets me. I didn't ask.
For sure.
I'll probably come up with a funny one now, and I'll go, bloody hell. I knew there was something funny. It was a bloke with a cock ring on. Actually, I do know one with a cock ring. I've got a great one with a cock ring.
Go on then.
Yeah, so basically, it was when I was flying, and we got called to a crew request for this patient, and it was an RTC, and I was with a very experienced doc, and we got there, and he was sort of set up for an anaesthetic because he was unconscious, this guy, and they stripped him off, and I pulled the blanket back, and I saw he had a cock ring on. I was like, hang on. I said, this is a drug overdose. It's not an RTC. And the doc was like, are you sure? I went, really sure. And they were like, hang on. Let's have a look at it. And we like slowed down. We're like, hang on, slow down. So he said, how do you know? I went, he's got a cock ring. He has taken G. I guarantee he's taken G. And so we're like, right, okay, we're not going to knock him out. Because obviously the knocking out causes other issues. So we took him in, handed him over. And it was another HEMS doc that we handed over to. And I went, And this, the doc went, he's got this. And the HEMS doc knew as well. She was like, yeah, this is G. He's got a Cochrane. I was like that. But, you know, it's not in any manual, but the spotting of a Cochrane generally means they've taken a G overdose.
And that's what
G
experience is.
Yeah, definitely. Right? Yeah. Yes, that's it.
Okay. Well, that's a good place for us to finish off with our final question.
Off. Go on.
Which is
not on the cock ring. Don't finish on the cock ring.
If you could change one thing to make the job easier, what would it be? Imagining that budgets were not an issue, which is blue sky thinking, what would you change?
I think society now, we need to change who we are. We're not an emergency service. We need to acknowledge that now. We need to acknowledge we're an urgent care service, or we make a decision between the two. More of us, that's all I can say. We need more mm-hmm. ambulances and more staff. And make it a more comfortable place. The whole environment needs to be comfortable for staff so we're not smashed all the time, and allow managers to manage us properly, and micromanagement. That's what I change, is to change the micromanagement. We need to stop that mm-hmm. because it doesn't work. And I've seen it in 23 years, I've seen it go round and round in a circle. Same things, and the new manager comes along. That's what I change. Stick with it. Even if it's negative for staff, stick with it because mm-hmm. it's boring. You know, it doesn't work. You're not listening. What would I know? I'm only a paramedic, so that's it. So yeah, that's what I changed. Micromanagement.
Okay, brilliant. Right, Kingham, I've loved having you on the show. Thank you so much for sharing your stories with us. And my final bit is, if our listeners happen to come across a paramedic today or tomorrow, instead of asking us that question that we said really grinds our gears, what question should they ask us?
How's your day been?
Perfect. Simple and a good way to start a conversation.
Yeah, that's it. Just be nice, I think. Just be nice. Polite. I'm old school. I like manners.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming. Turn the TV off. That's an idea. Turn the bloody TV. Your phone 999. Turn the TV off. For goodness sake.
Brilliant.
And stop apologising that you haven't tidied up. I can see you haven't tidied up for the last 10 years. No need to apologise.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We're here to provide an authentic voice for uniformed professionals and give our listeners a realistic insight into the jobs we do. And you've done just that, Kingham. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Lovely to see you again,
Kim. Yeah, you too. Well, that's it for today's episode. We'll be back next week speaking with another uniformed professional about what it's like beneath the blue lights. Thank you for being here, lending your ears to our frontline workers. We're here to shift the conversation, and we can't do that without you. Thank you to Kingham for being our guest today. Remember to follow us on The Paramedic Pod on Twitter and The Paramedic Podcast on Instagram. If you found this podcast to be useful and enjoyed listening, please do leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people like yourself find the show. Thank you to Pure Creation Media for producing the podcast. I'll see you next week.